We're continuing to work our way through some of the Psalms that we hadn't talked about just yet, Psalms which may have been written during the period of King Solomon's reign. And we're going to pick up today in Psalm number 99. Psalm number 99. Remember to feel these Psalms because they are emotional in their content. He who is reigns, let the peoples tremble. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim, let the earth quake. Now remember that the cherubim are four-faced, four-winged, angelic creatures. But they are represented in the architecture, first of the tabernacle, and now in the grand and glorious temple of He Who Is, built by Solomon. And it is pictured that God is seated upon the Ark of the Covenant, which is a throne, and that His voice emanates from between the cherubim that are at either end of that throne. Verse 2, He who is great in Zion. He is exalted over all the peoples. Now, Zion is the name for wherever the Ark is located. It started out being the name of the city of Jerusalem that David occupied. Then when the Ark of the Covenant is shifted up to the Temple Mount, that becomes Mount Zion. Ultimately, Mount Zion represents wherever God is. And so sometimes, poetically, heaven, the unseen realm, is Mount Zion. But wherever it is, God is on His throne, and He's being exalted. Verse 3, let them praise Your great and awesome name. Holy is He. Remember, His name represents He who is. And so, He who is holy. Verse 4, the King in His might loves justice. You've established equity. You've executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. So, it's supposed to be a fair kingdom when God is on the throne. And Israel's supposed to be a theocracy, ruled by God Himself. Verse 5, exalt He who is our God, worship at His footstool, holy is He. Now, footstool here represents the place where the Ark of the Covenant is situated. So the temple, the Ark, all of that is kind of folded in this idea that that's where God's feet touch the earth. So He's represented as being on the throne in the temple at Jerusalem, and He is holy. Moses and Aaron were among His priests. Samuel also was among those who called upon His name. They called to He who is, and He answered them. So we go back in time here, and we think about some of the big names. Moses and Aaron at the very beginning. Samuel, the great prophet that bridges between the time of the judges and the time of the kingdom. In the pillar of the cloud, He spoke to them, and they kept His testimonies and the statute that He gave them. That's the Shekinah glory that apparently not just Moses and Aaron interacted with, but also Samuel. He who is our God, You answered them. You were a forgiving God to them, but an avenger of their wrongdoings. So God defended and responded to these leaders in their time periods, but He also gave chiding and discipline to all of them, Moses, Aaron, and Samuel, for whenever they got off kilter. Verse number 9, exalt He who is our God and worship at His holy mountain, for He who is our God is holy. So it's kind of a call of worship to come to Mount Zion, come to Jerusalem, come to the temple, and recognize that this is the God that has always been, and He is due worship. Psalm number 100. which I have to acknowledge is one of my favorite psalms as a call to worship. And it says here that it is a psalm for giving thanks. Make a joyful noise to he who is all the earth. Serve he who is with gladness. Come into his presence with singing. We need to express ourselves musically, poetically, in our praise of God. Know that he who is, he is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. So we are made in the image of God. We are the climax of his creative efforts. We are here because he wanted us to be here, to be like him, to be holy as he is holy. And we are part of his flock if we will only just allow ourselves to be. Verse 4, enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. When the Israelis came to the Temple Mount, they were singing and praising God as they came in. And I hope we have the same attitude in mind whenever we come together for worship as the body of Christ. Give thanks to him, praise or bless his name. It's this idea that we want to reach out to him to say thank you for what you've done for us. God's been at his salvation efforts since before the creation of the world. He already knew it was going to get screwed up. And so he's been working on this for millennia, and we ought to be appreciative. For he who is good. His steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. So it just keeps on going, generation after generation after generation. He wants people from that generation to have a relationship with him, and he loves them and wants to bring them into eternity. Psalm 101, and this one actually does say it is a psalm of David, so we're going to skip over it, because we've already talked about it, and move forward until we come to Psalm 104. Psalm 104. And this is what it says. Bless he who is, O my soul. O he who is my God, you are very great. So this is a psalm that we start by encouraging ourselves to get busy with thanking God for who he is. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent. So we've got this picture that God is in nature, dressing himself in the majesty, surrounding himself with the amazing aspects of his creation. He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters, and he makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. Some of this imagery is actually borrowed from Canaanite, I believe, poetry that was directed toward Baal. But Baal's a fake god. God's the real deal. And so they simply grabbed it and brought it over and applied it to the real God. Verse number 4, I wanted to hold off on it because it gets quoted in the New Testament book of Hebrews as part of the proof that Jesus is more significant than any of the angels. And during the time that the book of Hebrews was written, certain groups amongst the Jews were really big into angels and practically worshiped them. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying, you've got to knock that nonsense off because Jesus is the one where you need to really be putting your worship because he's greater than the angels. And so here is what was quoted. Psalm 104, verse 4. He makes his messengers winds and his ministers a flaming fire. Now that's the English Standard Version representation of the Hebrew. The Greek, I think, which is then quoted in the book of Hebrews and is applied, I think makes the better translation of what was intended here. And let me phrase it the way I think it was intended. He makes his angels or his messengers out of spirits. See, the word for wind and spirit, same word in Hebrew, and it can be a similar word in Greek as well. So his angels are spirits that are working on his behalf. And he makes as his ministers flaming fire beings and the seraphim. The word seraph in Hebrew has the idea of something that's burning up, that's on fire. And so some of the angelic beings look exactly like that, like they're burning with light. And so God has his angels working in our world, working on his behalf. And so in the book of Hebrews, the Hebrew writer says, they're just servant class. In fact, by the time he gets to, I think it's verse 14 of chapter 1, the writer of Hebrews says, are they not all ministering spirits sent to see to the needs of those who will inherit salvation? So angels are not where we should be putting our focus. They're just messenger boys. They're just servant class that are sent to take care of jobs on behalf of ourselves at God's direction. All right, so back to our Psalm 104 passage, which is highlighting how significant God is. Verse 5, he set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains, and at your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not cover the earth. Now, this passage seems to be kind of a mixture of creation and flood remembrances. That when God created earth, he created it out of liquid. And he brought the dry land up above the water. And so we have the dry land or earth surrounded by the waters of the earth. And it's poetically described that the waters are like a garment that are covering part of planet Earth. But then we had the flood come along, and the water covers the entire land again. And when the flood is over, God causes mountains, big mountains like Mount Everest and the Rocky Mountains and the Cascades and the Andes, the Himalayas. God causes these new, marvelously high mountains to rise up, and he causes the deep valleys to sink down. And I think that's a reference to the trenches in the ocean, and that brought the sea level back to a manageable level again after the flood. And then he pretty much established a general boundary where you're never going to see the dry land completely overwhelmed by water again. That's the promise of the rainbow. Every time we see the rainbow, according to the book of Genesis, we're supposed to think, ah, the next time God decides to bring judgment on the earth, it's not going to be by water, because he promised that'd never be the case again. Next time it's going to be by fire. Verse number 10. You make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. So here's praise for the water system that God provides. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. So God's providing the water system that provides animal and plant life. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth. Wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. So this is kind of an old style blessing that God is the one that provides the food we eat every day. God's the one that provides the drink. Wine is particularly focused in on here because the fruit of the vine produced the wine. Oil, which is olive oil, which they put on their faces as part of their hygiene, and their faces glowed shiny because of that. And then, of course, all of the grain being made into flour, being made into bread, that gave basic strength to humanity. All of that comes from natural things that God put in place as the Creator. Verse 16, the trees of He who is are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon that He planted. Cedars of Lebanon are always looked at as being kind of the epitome of God's trees in the Middle East. They were big, solid, tall trees, very majestic. We would probably speak of the sequoias, the redwoods, as a similar representation of God's creative abilities in regard to trees. Verse 17, in them the birds build their nests. The stork has her home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats, and the rocks are a refuge for the rock badgers. So everywhere you look, everywhere this psalmist looks, he sees God's handiwork. He made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. And we know that the great lights were put into the sky to function as timekeeping devices. You can see the moon go through its phases. And the Israelis in particular would have been aware of this. They knew new moons started the beginning of a month, full moon, middle of the month, and very often associated with feasts. And then the waning moon represented the end of a month. And so all of that's just timekeeping. Sunrise, that's time to get up. Sunset, that's time to get ready to go to bed and get some rest. Verse 20, you made darkness, and it is night when all the beasts of the forest creep about. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away and lie in their dens, and man goes out to his work and to his labor until the evening. Apparently, the cougars, the lions that they knew, were much more nocturnal. And so people, though, got up in the morning and went to work. Verse 24, oh, He who is, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you've made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things, both small and great. So he's been talking about the land, and now he goes back to the sea and how the sea is just full of life. Verse 26, there go the ships and Leviathan, which you form to play in it. Now, Leviathan is some sort of big sea creature. It's mentioned in the book of Job, chapter 41, I believe. And it doesn't sound like a whale. It sounds all the world more like a plesiosaur or maybe one of the large, one of the other large creatures that we have discovered the bones for, that represents the majesty of God's creation. Verse 27, these all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. So God is pictured here as the one who provides the cycle of sustenance for all creatures to eat. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. And when you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. So life is dependent upon God. When you send forth your spirit, they're created, and you renew the face of the ground. So God is the one that keeps the cycle of life going. May the glory of He who is endure forever. May He who is rejoice in His works, who looks on the earth and it trembles, who touches the mountains and they smoke. And before we've talked about how that might be a remembrance of events at Mount Sinai. Although the ancients, at least some of them that were well enough traveled, were familiar with volcanic eruptions and how these were kind of like smoking mountains. Verse 33, I will sing to He who is as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have being. May my meditation be pleasing to Him, for I rejoice in He who is. So this is all put together as a reminder that we need to praise God. Let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. So let God's judgment eventually fall. Bless He who is, O my soul. Praise the Lord, or praise He who is. Psalm 105. Oh, give thanks to He who is. Call upon His name. Make known His deeds among the peoples. One of the reasons to sing psalms is to talk about what God's done and how glorious He is in that. Sing to Him. Sing praises to Him. Tell of all His wondrous works. Glory in His holy name. Let the hearts of those who seek He who is rejoice. See, we're supposed to be excited and happy about all of this information being gotten out. Seek the Lord. Seek He who is and His strength. Seek His presence continually. Remember the wondrous works that He has done, His miracles, and the judgments He uttered. Oh, offspring of Abraham, His servant, children of Jacob, His chosen ones. So this is targeted specifically to Israelis. They have had a long-standing relationship with the Creator God, and so they ought to be singing about Him and praising Him. He is He who is our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He remembers His covenant forever, the word that He commanded for 1,000 generations, the covenant that He made with Abraham, His sworn promise to Isaac, which He confirmed to Jacob as a statute, to Israel as an everlasting covenant. So we've got that threesome generation, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the promise that was made saying, to you, I will give the land of Canaan as your portion for an inheritance. So the promised land being given to the Israelites. Verse 12, when they were few in number, of little account, and sojourners in it, wandering from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people, He allowed no one to oppress them. He rebuked kings on their account, saying, touch not my anointed ones, do my prophets no harm. Now, this is a remembrance, a poetic remembrance, that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob didn't have a home. They moved from place to place, and yeah, sometimes they got hassled, but no one was able to annihilate them because God protected them and warned people off. We even have some examples that even at times when they were misbehaving, God still stepped in and protected them in the midst of that so He could keep His promise. And His biggest promise, of course, is in your seed, O Abraham, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And the Apostle Paul in Galatians chapter 3 makes a very big deal out of that being a promise about the coming of Jesus, the coming of the seed of Abraham. Verse 16, when he summoned a famine on the land and broke all supply of bread, he had sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. So now we learn from history again, a little reminder here, that even when famine shows up, God had a plan in mind. He'd already sent Joseph through circumstances that were intended as wrong, evil. God turned it into something good. Verse 18, his feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron. So he got treated like a slave until what he had said came to pass and the word of he who is tested him. So that's the whole idea, that he was a slave until his prophetic abilities started shining. And then verse 20, the king sent and released him. The ruler of the people set him free. He made him lord of his house and ruler over all his possessions, to bind his princes at his pleasure and to teach his elders wisdom. So love the story of Joseph, how he went from slavery to being the number two guy in all of Egypt. Verse 23, then Israel came to Egypt. Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. So Joseph's dad, Jacob slash Israel, comes to Egypt. Verse 24, and he who is made his people very fruitful and made them stronger than their foes. He turned their hearts to hate his people, to deal craftily with his servants. So the writer of this psalm is just going through Israeli history, highlighting how God is bringing his plan forward through all of these actions, and how God ought to be praised for how he is able to bring good out of even some of the roughest times, like, for example, Joseph being made a slave, and even the Israelis being turned into slaves in their time in Egypt. Well, we're out of time for right now, so we'll have to pick up in the middle of Psalm 105 next time we're together.